Welcome to the Week in Sports Cars, part of the Marshall Pruitt podcast. And despite Marshall's name being on it, he's not going to be on it, as it were, for the next couple of weeks, as he's getting stuck into Indianapolis 500 duties. So before we get into what is going to be a quick flappy gums episode of Twisk, let's hear from those that helped to make this happen.
Time to say a big thank you to our show partners on the Marshall Pruitt podcast, starting with FAF Technologies. Build-to-print composites manufacturing company. They're specializing in medium to large-scale automotive, motorsports, and military applications. Visit FAFTechnologies.com. It's P-F-A-F-F Technologies.com to learn more about their services and how they can benefit your business. Next, it's the Justice Brothers, makers of premium additives, lubricants, and cleaners, and servicing the automotive and motorsports industries for more than 85 years. With victories in all the biggest North American motor races, including the Indianapolis 500, the 24 Hours of Daytona, the Justice Brothers products are truly race-proven. Learn about their vast history and range of offerings at justicebrothers.com. If you're fond of awesome motor racing collectibles, including FAF Motorsports McLaren gear and goodies, pay a visit to torontomotorsports.com. And finally, we have a new online merchandise home for the podcast. ThePruittStore.com for all the show stickers, models, racing memorabilia I'm trying to sell and put towards our fund to buy a house is now live and rocking. ThePruittStore.com.
Well, joining me for this edition and indeed next week's edition with MP on roundy roundy, fasty fasty duty at the Indy 500 is my friend and news editor of DailySportsCar.com, Stephen Kilby. Afternoon, Stephen.
Good afternoon, Graham. How are you?
We're all good. We're both back from the 6 hours of Spa-Francorchamps. And boy, that was a race meeting to conjure with. We've also had IMSA racing this week. Our intention was to have a listener question Q&A version of the show this week. We're going to just put that back a few days because it's been quite a few days on the travel and catching up with stuff fronts. So for now, we're going to wrap up in particular about the news and two stellar events, two stellar race circuits. You and I both at Spa-Francorchamps for the FIWC, but let's start with Laguna Seca, WeatherTech Laguna Seca and IMSA's WeatherTech Sports Car Championship. Quite a race there as well. A few notable results, a couple of notable incidents, a couple of spats on Twitter to catch up with. Another good race for IMSA's Premier Series.
Yes, yeah, really successful race. I think the changes to the circuit, the resurfacing of that track has really added additional strategy elements to it. That seemed to be kind of the overarching theme of the weekend, and from what I saw of that race, it was a really entertaining one.
Yeah, Penske taking the win with the number six car in the hills of Monterey and circuit now with new leadership after the uncertainties that dogged Laguna Seca for so long, a new circuit CEO named just this week. The AO Racing Porsche, which we never call the AO Racing Porsche.
Because AO Racing of a Porsche?
They do, but what's it called? What's it called, Stephen?
Is that Rexy?
It is indeed Rexy. Rexy takes the first GTD Pro win of his million-year career. Meanwhile, Wynwood gets their third GTT victory, but did so in controversial circumstances. Robbie Foley getting somewhat punted by, I think, Jordan Taylor in one of the WTR Andretti Acuras. Bit of a spat, as I say, at the top of the show on Twitter about this. We've had a look at the in-car coming into the turn. None other than Nicky Katzberg getting stuck into Turner Motorsports social media on this one. I've had a look at that, and I have to tell you, I'm not sure what else Robbie Foley could possibly have done.
He could have been on the gravel, Graham, just driven off the circuit in avoidance. We've seen that a few times this year.
We have seen that a few times, but such a shame for Turner Motorsport, their 557th race with BMW this weekend, overtaking the epic total of BMW starts for none other than Schnitzer Motorsports. They are now the most experienced BMW race team in history, and I'm sure that I'd love to celebrate that with a win, that wasn't possible, unfortunately, here. I'm not going to get into spats on Twitter, other than the rules are pretty simple. You've got to find a safe way by. I know the defence was apparently that the BMW had not made it easy for the GTP car to pass at the previous two turns. Here's the news, guys. It's not their job to make it easy to pass you. They've got to stick to the racing line. And on this occasion, from the evidence, little bit of evidence that I've seen, I've absolutely no idea what else the BMW driver could have done other than what he did do, which was allow himself to be hit in the door and pushed off through the gravel, losing what I believe at that stage was a 10-second lead.
Yeah, it's kind of a shame when it comes down to sort of little on-track incidents like that, especially when it's battles for leading key classes in major races. But as a whole, you've got to sort of tip your cap to Turner, haven't you, for their just ridiculous history racing with BMW. Did it surprise you when you saw the total, just how many races they'd been in? Because for me, I was like, I genuinely...
It is a staggering
if
number.
If you'd have said to me, oh, who's closest to Schnitzer, I wouldn't have immediately reached for Turner's name. It really is impressive. It's impressive.
It's very, very impressive. And I think the answer is not really got a handle on it. But, you know, what we do know is that Turner, of course, have been in multiple series over multiple years. Will Turner, the man behind Turner Motorsport, now 117 years old, which is some... Well done, Will. I said, well done, Will. You've done very well. Okay.
Yeah, one of the more remarkable teams in the sport today.
It is, and you know, enhanced enormously by what is you know, a happy-go-lucky outlook, which I'm sure was in full flood post-race after that particular incident. So what it leaves is it is Dane Cameron and Felipe Nasr at the top of the pile in the Drivers' Championship, ahead of Jack Aitken and Pipo Derani, Sepp Bourdais and Renger van der Zander. Third, Louis Delatraz and Jordan Taylor, just over 100 points off Mathieu Jaminet and Nick Tanti, with that win closing up dramatically the top five there across three different factory teams in the WeatherTech Championship. And switching over to the WEC side, we're seeing three factory teams, and as you'll hear in just a little wee while, and more than just the factory teams, in real contention in the WEC as well. Does feel as if in this GTP hypercar era, Stephen, it's beginning to come to the boil.
Yes, 100%. We now are at a point where there are so many factories that are kind of properly on top of their cars, and privateer teams, it must be said, that are on top of their cars, that we go into a race weekend and it's just a different level of unpredictability. My dad actually made the point to me earlier today when I was on the phone because he was at Spa spectating. And his point was, you know, leaving the red flag at Spa aside, if you'd have gone into that race weekend and sat around the table and tried to draw up what you thought was going to happen in either of the two classes and who you thought was going to finish where, you probably would have, you know, it would have taken you days to come up with that combination. It really was amazing, wasn't it? And for that reason, it's an absolute pleasure to watch WC and IMSA races at the moment, because there is just no boring aspect to it. Is it? All the races are interesting to watch and the results are interesting as well. It's not the same teams and drivers week in, week out dominating. The level of competition is so high across the board, and there's so many teams that are capable of fighting for championships. And I actually wrote about it for Racer during the weekend, that it does feel different at WEC races now. It feels like teams and drivers more than ever before are really starting to focus on scoring as many points as possible and looking at the championship standings in WEC in ways that we've not seen in previous years, where, you know, just about preparing for Le Mans, and then by the time you got to Le Mans, you know, you sort of then started to look at the championship. Now it's different, isn't it?
It is. And I think, you know, there is certainly, it seems, more of an appetite for a proper world championship run. And let's be blunt, the kind of level of interest we saw at Imola, and that was more than retained, in fact, enhanced by what we saw at Spa-Francorchamps on Saturday, is only going to help that. I had a long chat with couple of manufacturers and a couple of the WC's partner organisations, technical partner organisations, and asked about, you know, does it make a difference when there's 72,000 people at Imola and 88,000 people, as there were, at Spa over the weekend? And the answer is absolutely it does, because what it means is whether or not you're encouraging people to come to an event to see your product, or whether or not you're engaging in business-to-business activity, bringing customers in, who doesn't like to go to a significant event? And a significant event either means something that is so elite that literally every whistle and bell is covered, or that vast numbers of people flock to. And that's what we've had for the last two races. And I'm not going to say anything other than it's been a real buzz to be part of those events. It's been a real buzz to see full grandstands and happy people in the paddock and loads of families. You know, absolutely great to see loads of mums and dads and kids, you know, and enjoying the access that you get at a sports car race that quite often you don't at very many other kinds of events. So for me, it does feel like we've turned a corner.
100%.
Let's hope that that can be maintained. It's Le Mans next, of course, and that is a effectively sold-out event on race day at least. I'm told there's big numbers expected in Interlagos in Brazil, which is the first of the summer races. There's always a good crowd at, in Japan at Fuji. So lots more buzz to come. Loads of stuff going on for us in the background. But let's have a think about some of the storylines from that race. And let's start at the back of the field. Let's start talking about GT. By far, the best WC GT3, LMGT3 race we've seen so far.
I think LMGT3 race as a whole, including the LMS as well.
Yeah,
I think that's the best race of that formula. It provided action, didn't it, all the way through. And it wasn't just that it was unpredictable or that somebody built a lead, lost it all, and then you got a surprise winner. It was that throughout that race, there were door-to-door battles. There were some standout performances in qualifying and throughout, you know, the entire extended 6 hours that we saw. And it just made the entire class just had shades of what we used to see in GTE with trains of really feisty drivers going at it.
Pass the lead on the final lap with the Pure Racing team. Well, let's face it, if you'd have seen that shunt on Friday in isolation, you'd have thought, one, there's a team that's not going to be starting the race, and two, I really hope that driver's okay, because that was a horrible shunt for Alex Malikin up at Radial.
Yeah, who was a little bit bruised from it, I'm told, but was cleared very quickly by the doctors and said he could race again. The team worked way into the morning, didn't they, building that
7 o'clock
new...
in the morning, that car.
It's really
one of the Grello cars from the Nürburgring campaign. I mean, Mantai Racing is only about 90 minutes away from Spa, just over the German border. But that doesn't matter. Number one, you've got to basically change that car to have all the relevant kits on it, so that it was a replacement chassis. You've then got to build it up as an LMGT3 car, which is not the work of a moment. Everything's got to be calibrated and checked. And, of course, they had no track time to check that car out.
And I started building it, having already done a full day of work.
Indeed.
So hats off to the guys in that garage, because they got a really big result, didn't they, Mantai?
They did.
And they deserved it, really, for the efforts that were put in.
It was great to see Olaf Mantai there to see it and clearly enjoying the day. And, of course, it was a pass for the lead on the final lap by the other Mantai car. Beyond that, heartbreaker game for the Iron Dames. Stellar stint from the very, very shiny bronze that is Sarah Bovey, building up a 40-second plus lead before the first safety car came out and ruined that day for them. But that wasn't it. It was another muffed pit stop, I'm afraid, at the same corner that cost them the race win in the Porsche in the European Le Mans Series. And after that, it would be, I think, fair to say that the blood was running pretty high for Michel Gatting. Contact to the rear of one of the Porsches, am I right? Multiple times. I think it might have been the EMA car.
Well, the push that she... The penalty was for pushing the Pure Racing car for the bus stop, wasn't it?
But, you know, and ultimately they lost their fourth place. So that was the tale of one of the Lamborghinis. The other one could have should have won. And there was some extraordinary stuff going on in terms of fuel mileage in that car. Frank Pereira in the yellow Lamborghini to the end of the race and asking basically what his position was and being told he was absolutely fine. And then almost, what, a lap later, being told he had to splash for fuel at the end. So he clearly was not being given the message that could have allowed him to fuel manage the end of the race. Could he have made it? I don't know. What we can tell you is Pure Racing managed to cross the line with an epic fuel save, with 0.2% of energy in the tank at the end of that race. So they managed it perfectly, or very much on the edge. Lamborghini cost themselves a real shot at a victory in Spa. A couple of other storylines, one of which is a team that took great strides forward. Initially were second and fourth on the grid in MGT3, lost the second place on the grid to the car being very marginally underweight. United Autosports, the McLaren. But in particular, it's the 59 car that was right there all the way through. Could have won that race.
Yes, 100%. The biggest strides, they've taken big strides clearly in getting used to the car at United. And I think we've said before, it came together very late, that programme. And it's not a team that has been running that car elsewhere for years. So it's taken them a little bit of time, as it has for teams like Akodis, to get their heads around it. But what stood out to me from United was the two bronze drivers and their performances. Josh Cahill and James Cottingham both looked in different shape at Spa. I don't know if that's because they're more used to racing at Spa. I know James Cottingham has obviously been there with British GT.
And historic racing.
Yes, yep. And Imola's a circuit that not as many people as you'd think had raced at in a GT3 car. But they really just looked the part. They looked right up there with the other, you know, the bronzes that you kind of would expect. You sort of actually, Ahmed Ahati and Sara Bovi and Alex Malik and to a certain extent Darren Leung are the guys that you would immediately go, right, they're going to be in the top four. But actually they've kind of become fifth and sixth and maybe even better. I'm really looking forward to seeing what they can do for the rest of the season. They'll get a confidence boost from that, won't they?
You mentioned the boost for the Akodis ASP Lexus team. They were far more convincing at a circuit that clearly the team knows very well in their Mercedes AMG days. Worth saying that WRT 1-2, remember, last time out in Imola, both those cars punted out in someone else's accident and out of the race. But the other team taking a big step forward was Proton Competition, and that's not the last time you're going to hear those words, and their Ford Mustangs. And you sniffed out a story on that.
Yeah, so they've had been granted an erratum fix by the FIA to sort out the issues that they were having with the boot lid and the diffuser on the Mustang, which has been a common issue, you know, everywhere that car is raced.
It's been not common, it's been ever present, hasn't it?
Pretty much. I think the only times I remember it not happening is at Paul Ricard. I think the car that was racing at Paul Ricard in the opening round of World Challenge was fine and had a pretty good race. But pretty much everywhere else, you know, that car was coming home with half of its rear end off.
Well, you can read that story on Daily Sports Car from Stephen, posted late last week. But basically what it comes down to is it was measured risk. The choices that were made with the fastenings for both of those sections of the car, erring towards serviceability rather than ultimate reliability. And what they've realised is they made a mistake in making those judgment calls. And the early parts of the season showed that they needed to reverse that. That's been done. We didn't see a failure of either item at all in what was a pretty feisty at times Spa-Francorchamps race. And let's hope for the cars on both sides of the pond, because the same fix was in place for the cars at Laguna Seca, that they can continue now and start to find the pace within that package. That was LMGT3. Significantly more storylines to come, though. Let's talk first about drivers, and in particular, emerging talent. We're seeing it probably a little more on the WEC side than the IMSA side, a lot more the established talent on the IMSA side. But with the WEC, and for that matter, the European Le Mans Series, the big change for me, ELMS last year, when you read down the list of pro drivers, it was just a fashion show of talent and fame. This year's a bit different, but in no way less engaging, because what we're seeing is an emergence of a group of talented young drivers in LMP2. And as you'll hear in a moment or two, some of those making their way into hypercar. That means what's already an exciting era for lots of reasons has yet another layer to it.
Yeah, 100%. It's been one of the most fun storylines to follow in sports car racing in the last 12 months, and particularly now we're kind of seeing it all come to a head, aren't we? Every time you go to an ELMS race, it's an absolute barnstormer with existing factory drivers, young upstart F2 guys making the jump.
And F3.
And, just, yep. And guys like Michael Jacobson, who haven't even touched single-seaters and have just gone down the sports car route and are proving to be absolutely rapid. And seeing them filter into the WC slowly and make the most of the fact that we've got such a huge hypercar field with so many seats to fight for. And we're going to see a lot more of this in the next 12 months or so when we get into contract renewals for a lot of the drivers for the factories. There's just, how do you choose with that pool of talent right now?
Well, you know, you've got, I think there's a fair number of existing factory drivers that will be looking over their shoulder at these youngsters coming and thinking, this is going to be hard work the next 2 or 3 years. You know, you mentioned Melty Jacobson, Brituma Miata is another. You've got, we'll come to the standout performance for me from Spa in a moment, but then you look at the European Le Mans series and there's a dozen more, you know, teenagers and upwards that are already quick and getting quicker, as well as those that are still hungry and trying to make their way, you know, force their way through the crowd at the kind of the hypercar bar to try to get served with an opportunity there as well. You know, look at, you know, people like Job van Uytter, for instance, who deserves a chance. You've got, I know, some stories to come for DSC about others that might have made it but didn't quite in at least one of the hypercar teams. This is sort of teeing up, though, one of the storylines from Spa that had us up and cheering. And that came, it's not from the least likely place, because we've seen pace from this team this season, but one of the less likely areas to provide not just a moment, but 2 hours of moments. And that, stand up, and in fact 3 hours of moments, because it was a two-driver squad this time out. Stand up and take the plaudits, Julian Andlauer, because it seemed to me, Stephen, that every time the camera switched to him, he was going very rapidly. He was doing that with consistency. He was either challenging for a position, taking that position, or driving away to find the next one in the queue. And that run was peppered with epic, entirely fair overtakes, the like of which every motorsport fan wants to see.
Oh, 100%. He was utterly world class in that race, to the point where, and you don't see it very often, you tend to see this happen towards the end of lengthy endurance races like 24-hour races or the 12-hour races, where there's a cracking move for the lead and the press room erupts,
yep,
like applause and cheering. He had the press room applauding the screens four or five times in that race and audibly gasping four or five other times. He was outstanding. And the best thing about it was is the fact that going into the race, when I look back at his performance at Sebring, and I remember the moment at Sebring when the sun went down and it was into darkness, and Proton didn't get a big result at Sebring because it all went horribly wrong in the closing minutes of that race, but Andlauer was strapped in that car and basically just told to go after that last restart. And it was one of those, oh, hello, here comes Julian Andlauer moments. And you thought, okay, he's up to speed now. And it was great to see that performance at Sebring that I thought really stood out carry over into this race. And not just for a few laps, but both times he got in the car, just that run to the lead at the start. And Ant on the commentary was saying multiple times, he's going to burn his tyres. There's no way he can keep this up. He's going to burn his tyres. It was like, it just, you got to the halfway mark of the race and you're thinking, it's going to be an upset if they don't win this now. They look so strong.
They did. They were one of a number of teams that the red flag cost dear in terms of their, just where they were on their strategy calls. But put that aside, and hats off to Proton Competition as a whole, but to you, Julian Andlauer, in particular, that was very special indeed. I hope you're going to see more of it.
For for fans and people trackside and people who follow this sport who maybe don't know the minutiae of what's going on in some of these paddocks, we're going to talk about Jota clearly and how amazing they were in that race. But what I've got to say is the difference between Proton and Jota is quite significant when you really look into the detail of this, because Proton don't go testing at all with their car. Their resources are on a different level to what we've seen in the rest of that paddock in hypercar, and to make the most of it in the way that they did was truly remarkable. They've shown flashes of pace and the odd really fast lap, and I think Sam Hignett said to us after the race, you know, they're usually really quick over one lap, but they were properly impressive over the entire race this time.
Yep.
That was the first time we'd seen Proton put it together for an entire race, and God, I hope it continues, because if they're a factor going forward in every race, it's going to be amazing to watch.
Worth saying, by the way, third place on the grid as well for that race, which matches their best ever overall grid place in an international sports car race, and that best ever was set in the second round of the European Le Mans Series the weekend before in Paul Ricciard and LMP2. So this is a team that is coming on strong at a million miles. That's three different series and three different cars we've mentioned about Proton, with the Mustangs as well. So well done, Christian Reed, Michael Reed, and your merry band of men and women travelling the world and kicking ass and taking names. Let's move on to talk about Earl Bamber. Caddy. That car is an enigma to me. Clearly there was a lot going on in terms of the way they were managing their tyres. Alex Lynn sort of was dealt the duff hand and was left for an hour and a half, if you like, trying to make tyres work that were already slightly second best. But somehow, somewhere, that car lit up. And Earl Bamber was carving his way through the field, fairly effectively so.
That was the plan coming together about using the using the old tyres early on.
Yeah. But it's fair to say that what transpired that brought out the red flag, with what, an hour and 44 minutes to go, was an epic misjudgment from Earl. And not one you very often see from, you know, a guy with a career as fantastic as the career he's got, not had, he's got. But that was a huge error from Earl Bamber.
Mm. And one of those sort of errors that you'd expect from one of the guys we've just been talking about, who's just stepped in one of those cars or is just trying to make a name for themselves. Earl Bamber's already got the CV that's utterly glittering, especially for his time with Porsche. So it was... Yeah, it was a real shame. Thank God he's okay, because that could have been so much worse, especially going into a concrete wall.
No, let's talk about what happened. He came up, it was actually with, oddly enough, the Proton competition Porsche, wasn't it?
It was
then
Gianni,
in the hands of Neil Gianni. But up and over Radeon, Gianni balked, unintentionally, of course, by Sean Galale in the WRT BMW, went to the centre of the road, and Earl, looking for the gap, chose to go to the inside, where, unfortunately, his rate of closing he'd miscalculated by the look of things, and he sort of hit both cars simultaneously. It wasn't he hit one and was nerfed into the other. He hit the rear right of the hypercar, and in trying to get to the inside, then hit the front left of the BMW, and then carnage. Couple of things to say. Thank you, rule makers, for putting those cars so strongly together, because that could have been so, so much worse. Looked to me as well as if all the changes that have been made to stop these cars from taking off actually worked pretty well. You could almost see the car physically stall in aerodynamic terms and come back down again. The circuit protection worked. I know at least one guy was on the media shuttle that was showered with debris from that that shunt. Didn't get the shot. But then, of course, it took a long time to sort that out. So sorry for WRT and Sean Galale, who was, you know, visibly upset by that, quite right too. And that brought out, Stephen, the red flag that then led to the next set of dramas we're going to talk about. So for now, I don't want to go on and on about it. These are marginal calls. It was a bad accident.
And it must be said that it was a split-second moment.
Of course it was.
Such a massive run up Radeon while the two cars ahead was visibly slower.
But that's... This is what a professional driver is there to do, is to make the right calls, the right judgment calls, split-second decisions. I'm not here to kind of crucify anybody. It was a bad mistake. He would be the first to admit it. It was a bad mistake. It ended a race for Cadillac that could have seen them...
finally make some inroads in the championship.
Absolutely. And instead, what they've got is a bag of bits.
Yeah, and a massive gaping hole where their points should be.
Yes. So, moving on from that, we then get into the red flag. Clock ticking down, and everybody wondering what's going to go on. It was a little... Well, I was there with, obviously, the WCTV crew. We started to get an inkling that something was going on, that it was going to be something different to that which we were seeing on the clock. But it was, what, 14 minutes to go on the clock when we finally were given the opportunity to tell our watching public that that race was effectively going to be reset, that we'd go with 144 minutes left, which was... I have to say, when that call came through, as a sports fan, I was elated. Okay? Absolutely elated. Why? Because after so many occasions on which decisions have been taken, which are ultra-conservative, in the case of some recent decisions, and particularly one famous decision at Spa itself, for Formula One, where it was blatantly a commercially-based decision. And frankly, not in the interest of the fans, against the interest of the fans, which I think is unforgivable. Greedy, I'll say it out loud. We'd had challenges for the weekend for the fans in getting to the circuit with some ill-timed roadworks in Francorchamps, meaning that some people were queuing for 2, 3, 4 hours to get there. And I'll say it out loud because this is my podcast and I can do, which is another piece of infrastructure work made necessary by demands for Formula One, which has massively affected another World Championship event. This needs to stop. This needs to be better managed, and it needs to be done in cycles of something less than 6 months, which seems to be what's going on. It's that, you know, you're left with a situation where major works are required that massively disrupt, you know, within a single year. And that's not fair. It's not fair to major venues, and it's not fair to the other series and championships that are using those major venues, or frankly, the fans that are using those major venues. Put all that aside, that's the moan, underline that bit. Great decision from the fans' point of view. We went back to racing. We'll talk about the second part of this race just shortly. Let's talk first about whose race it ruined. Can't move away without talking about Ferrari, who did very well all day to that point, were caught the wrong side of the decision and the rule book, found themselves having to pit their three cars, all of which were in competitive positions, twice. Once for emergency service, which of course put them to the back of the queue, and then, because that's the way the rule book goes, then having to go make a full service stop under green flag conditions. For me, and I'm keen to hear what you think, I, in sporting terms, completely agree that it was a genius decision to reset the clock. But in the same way that we've seen rules change in the past when those kinds of race-ruining decisions were made, it's going to affect somebody. In this case, it was Ferrari and others, including Proton, by the way. Maybe we need to think about some more clarity about better ways in which not to leave the situation as blatant as it was, or clear as it was, that you had three cars that had just pitted and 15 that hadn't, which meant that the two cars, as it turned out, that could really take advantage of it, they were the number 12 Hertz Team Jota car and the number 6 Porsche Penske Motorsport Porsche, had a minute's gap on the field. Last time I can recall it happening at this kind of level, at that blatantly, was the infamous occasion at Le Mans in GT Pro.
Yeah, with the safety cars, multiple safety cars splitting up the battle, which never kind of resumed afterwards.
And what then happened about that rule book? It was changed immediately to negate that possibility. I suspect we will hear from our powers that be that they'll be taking a look at that, and quite right that they should. I'll say it a third time, entirely supportive of what they actually did in sporting terms for the trackside fans. But I completely understand why Ferrari in particular are gutted and upset. They did protest the result, and that protest was overruled as you know, not being valid. I completely understand their point of view. I don't entirely disagree with their point of view.
No.
And I wish there had been an opportunity for the decision to be made that they effectively reset it at an hour and 44 minutes with everybody sitting there with a full tank of fuel.
Yeah.
Now, that, oddly enough, goes completely against my feelings around the rather more liberal attitude that some series have to red flag conditions. I do believe red flag should be red flag. This was extraordinary. Okay, this was different than most in that we restarted it having effectively reset the clock. For me, I think there would be a sensible discussion to be had about how that particular aspect could have been handled better in the interests of the whole field. And right now is a sensible time to do it when that field is so deep.
Yeah, 100%. And I'm kind of conflicted about it as well, because on one hand, you're trying to build the championship, and to put a sour taste in everybody's mouths and ask them to sit there for 2 hours and then finally be told, actually, you've got to go home is something.
It's awful.
You never want to see that, you know, particularly at a major race meeting where people have paid good money to get in, and lots of people had travelled a long way. It wasn't like a
lot of Brits there. There were a lot of Brits.
Yeah, a lot of people went to it. And that is in part because Le Mans is sold out, and it's hard to get tickets, and you're looking elsewhere and you think, okay, that's the obvious alternative.
And we have no Silverstone race, and we haven't had since.
The problem, the problem I've got is that kind of the precedent it's set. And the point was actually made really nicely at the end of the race. I think it was Martin Haven, your colleague in the commentary box.
I think I've heard of him.
Yeah, I've heard of him as well. I think most of people have heard him at least. who kind of made the point of, if this was a 24-hour race and you'd red flagged it for 3 or 4 hours, you wouldn't extend the 24-hour race by an additional 3 hours. If it was Sebring and it was going to end at whatever, 9 or 10 o'clock at night, whenever it usually finishes, and we'd had 3 hours of red flag, you wouldn't run until 2 in the morning. They've done it because of the length of the race and because fans were sitting there in the sunshine and there were loads of them still there, is the way it looked, at least on the outside. And the problem with that is, what does that mean going forward? Does that mean that any time there's a red flag, we're going to get a longer race? Is that going to be something that people then feel robbed and start campaigning for, you know, things don't go their way because we don't get an extension to a race, and if it had been extended, people would have had a better chance in future races? And it's that precedent for me.
I get that. Precedent is both a wonderful and at times a dangerous thing.
Because Ferrari were unlucky because it was a six-hour race.
I agree.
If it had been a 12-hour race, or it had been the Qatar race at the start of the season, I don't think that race gets extended.
Yeah, you know, and they would have won the race.
Yeah,
they would have counted back to the race. The lap before the incident happened.
And rightly so, because they weren't gifted 1-2 because of that.
They were competitive to that point, but the problem was, and now we're going to move on to our final point for the show, you then got into a phase of the race with the two cars I mentioned earlier, the number 6, surviving Porsche Penske Motorsport car, after the 5 was eliminated with an accident for Michael Christensen, and the surviving Hertz Team Jota car with Callum Ilott at the wheel. And that surviving car after 38 was punted by Rennie Rast in the incident that also accounted for the other WRT BMW, the 46 car, Armadale Harty. Callum Ilott, and none other than it's Kevin Estra, a minute ahead. And then you think, OK, can that gap be closed? The answer was, plot spoiler, no, it couldn't. Callum Eilert in the Hertz team Jota car, so relative newcomer to sports cars, in the privateer team with the same machinery.
And older tyres on one side of the car.
There you go. So at that point, you've got to say, well, Porsche Penske Motorsport are going to win that race. They'd taken a famous 100th pole position in Penske sports car racing history on Friday. It would have been Team Penske's 100th victory in professional sports car racing had they done so. That had to wait for the Monterey race the following
day. They didn't have to wait long, did they?
They didn't have to wait long. I have to say, we talked about the run from Julian Anslauer. Hats off to Callum Eilert, because he didn't look like losing that race.
No, and the odd thing is, I was having a discussion with a couple of people around the table when that race finally got underway, and we knew it was going to be a two-way battle. It was the kind of, all right, who's your money on now then? And it was evenly split around the table of Kevin and Callum, which shows you the talent that people have realised he's got. And he was magnificent. He didn't put a foot wrong, did he?
He didn't.
And in circumstances, like I said, they're running with a pair drivers rather than three. So he was racing, he was on the track more than a lot of other drivers, which will have had an effect. And just being able to mentally go from pitting at the red flag, they were sitting 10th, I believe, during the entire red flag period, thinking it was all over and that they'd made a massive error. So then having to switch on and go, right, oh my God, I've got an opportunity here. And take the opportunity and not get flustered by the fact that he's mentally probably prepared for this race to have been over. And then be told, actually, you're in the car and it's another hour and 44 minutes. That's a really impressive thing. That's elite level sporting.
Well, look, good weekend for the number six car and the championship run for manufacturers championship run for Porsche. They have been consistent, solid through this season so far. But we're going to finish this show by talking about Hertz Team Jota in a number of ways. 38 car, I think, coming into this with the star quality of Jenson Button. You would have thought that's going to be their lead car. It's not worked out that way. Callum Eilert has been a star aboard that car. Norman Nato on Formula E duty, but how delighted do you think he was to finish 18th in Berlin while his teammates were taking a world championship win? It's, for me, Hertz Team Jota from the start, it's been an impressive program. It looks like a world championship effort. It feels like a world championship effort. And now they're racing like it's a world championship effort. They're not in the hunt for the manufacturer's world title. They're looking to take scalps and win races. They've now done that. It is the first time, and I don't think it's going to be the last, that we'll see a privateer car taking the win in the hypercar and GTP eras. Congratulations, before we go any further, to everybody involved in that, to Sam Hignett, to David Clark, and it's so great to see David back at the circuits, because let's make no bones about it, that deal, that commercial deal that made this happen was his bailiwick, and it's great that he's here to see that triumph. To Tom Wagner and the guys behind the financial part of this, as the engine behind it. So the boys and girls in the garage, the engineers, the mechanics, everybody involved with Jota. Massive congratulations. That is an absolutely huge result. Make no mistake about it. That is an enormous result for any team to take an overall world championship race win. You know, it's extremely significant. And if you are seeing this as a kind of gateway drug to sports car racing, the Weekend Sports Cars podcast, it's sort of like Williams winning in Formula One.
Mm.
It's a bit like that. That's a little unfair. Jota have got race winning form in just about every formula they've ever competed in. But this is the little team that could. Significantly less resource than the teams around them, the factory teams around them. And I think even when they allow themselves a moment to remember that whatever emotions are around, we're still all sports fans, I think a lot of people at Ferrari would turn around and say, that was really well done.
In a similar way to when Lando won his first F1 race and the whole paddock was like, absolutely, fair play, bowing down to him, thoroughly deserved. I think it's a similar sentiment here for the Jota guys. What was really surprising to me is that we're in a weird moment, aren't we, with the privateer marketplace at this level, where it is now, where it's going, what these sort of results mean. But if you'd have said before the season started, right, this year a privateer team is going to win in either GTP or Hypercar, where's it going to happen first? You'd have said it's going to happen in the IMSA paddock because of that style of racing, yes, with late race restarts, and you know, potentially having a driver lineups that aren't quite as top quality and be able to fight your way through to the end of a race and luck out from a safety car wave around and get laps back. You'd have said it would be there. But to happen in a wet race just before Le Mans in a field this massive is just astonishing. And it will turn a lot of teams' heads who are thinking about getting in this arena. Because if there's space on that grid and you're looking at it and you're trying to make the finances work, you've got to ask yourself the question, what can we achieve? Yeah, there's the Hypercar World Cup, but it's got to be said, everyone involved in that doesn't care about it.
They want to win.
No, they want to win overall. Is it possible then? Well, they've just proven it is.
Well, the other thing is, the driver duo from Hertz Team, Jota, remarkably, after three races, now, because whilst they can't win the Manufacturers' World Championship, they can win the Drivers' World Championship, and the two guys that raced on Saturday are now second in the World Drivers' Championship.
Again, Norman Nato, if they go all the way,
that's going to be absolutely gutted. That is utterly remarkable. So, congratulations to all of them. And we now move on to start thinking about the Le Mans 24 Hours. And we'll tee it up like this. And there will be a lot more to say and do. And thanks for being patient with us, dear listeners. We will be giving you the opportunity to ask those questions, not just for next week's show, but also in shows we've got planned in the run-up to, and we hope, at the Le Mans 24 Hours.
And there's more news to come later this week, isn't there, Graham?
There's
going to be stuff you're going to want to ask questions there about, get your questions ready.
Yep. Stephen's been working very hard indeed on a pretty mold-breaking story that we hope to be running on Daily Sports Car and in some form as well on racer.com. That is absolutely crucial to the future of sports car racing. So we will be getting the call for questions out. Cracking stuff. Two great race meetings. Two fantastic tracks. Circuit management have both deserved massive plaudits. It's been a tough, tough time for the team at Spa-Francorchamps. But what they've produced at the end of it is an event to be proud of. At a circuit that's now truly world class in terms of the opportunities to view that are offered to the fans. It was a privilege to call it for WCTV. I know you thoroughly enjoyed your time there too. We now have just a few days away from race meetings before we dive into what is going to be an epic stretch of 24-hour and other race meetings, something like 7 or 8 weeks on the trot between the three big European 24-hour races at Nürburgring, at Le Mans, and then Spa and the centenary there. Then back to after a brief summer break, into Lagos for the WEC. We've got ALMS racing to come. We've got Watkins Glen to come for the IMSA WeatherTech Sports Car Championship in that same period. But there's some other special stuff coming too. Watch this space for what we're going to be up to coming into this summer. There's going to be some fun and games and some great opportunities to talk to some very interesting people. For now, I want to say thank you to Stephen Kilby for helping here. Good luck at Indianapolis and all else to our friend and colleague, Marshall Pruitt. With thanks, of course, as always, to Faf Technologies, to the Justice Brothers, and to TorontoMotorsports.com. I am Graham Goodwin. He's Stephen Kilby. This was The Week in Sports Cars, part of the Marshall Pruitt Podcast Collection, and we will be with you, we promise, this time with a listener-fueled podcast next week.